This July 4th weekend, flames and smoke will rise over backyards across the country. Americans will be grilling.
In the best case scenario, you get a tasty meal.
In the worst case, you get an awesome story of how you turned hamburger into charcoal briquettes or how you got grill marks on your hand.
Stephen Reichlin wants to help you stay on the right side of that line.
Can I just mention for people, you're really comfortable putting your fingers in the fire.
I've been doing this for a while, so
okay. Right.
Yeah.
Reichlin is the author of the Barbecue Bible. The other morning, he fired up three grills in a backyard and then slipped back inside to the kitchen.
So what we're going to do is an entire meal on the grill, from appetizer to dessert.
Okay.
And we're going to do sort of a celebration of regional American barbecue. Regional American barbecue.
So we're going beyond hamburger and hot dog.
Right.
Okay.
And
not that there's anything wrong with that,
okay.
But anyway.
Reichlin has spread out the ingredients on the kitchen island. He's got a slab of Alaskan salmon and a cedarwood plank to grill it on. He's got spices for Mexican corn on the cob, as eaten in Chicago, and he sliced open poblano peppers to stuff those green peppers with a mixture of
onion, cumin, garlic, pinto beans and black beans with grated pepper jack cheese.
He's brought in bread and butter and garlic to grill Texas toast. And off to the right are several pounds of uncooked pork.
Our meat main course today, pulled pork sliders, with a nod to South Carolina, spice rub, smoke roasted pork shoulder that'll be chopped and served on grilled buns with mustard slaw, mustard sauce.
Should I mention the barbecue sauce in the Carolinas is a little different than what Americans might be accustomed to elsewhere?
Absolutely. Well, in North Carolina, the barbecue sauce is a vinegar sauce. And in South Carolina and Georgia, the barbecue sauce is a mustard-based barbecue sauce. So that's what we're going to do today. Finally, to finish up from Georgia, cinnamon grilled peaches with vitamin B3 glaze. And those three vitamins are brown sugar, butter, and bourbon.
I'm ready to go.
Yes, we are going to grill peaches on one of the three grills that are already smoking outside.
So now what I'd like to do is we've kind of done all of our prep.
Okay.
We're going to head outside and we're going to get to work on the grill.
Three factors will affect this meal. The first is the food itself.
All right.
Wow, that is a lot of pork. That is a big hunk of pork.
So what we have here is a pork shoulder, also called a Boston butt.
The next factor is what you put on the food before it's cooking and while it cooks.
After the first hour and every hour thereafter, this is called a mop sauce. It's a mixture of vinegar, mustard, and spices.
And you've actually got a tool that looks like a little mop.
And it is a little miniature mop. And we swab this over the meat. It adds an extra layer of flavor. It helps keep the meat moist, and it looks really cool.
And the biggest factor, of course, is the star of the show, the fire.
Just realized I was about to set the microphone on fire there. That might not be good.
One of our grills runs on gas. The others are simple kettle grills, which he's gradually filling with charcoal. Or not really filling.
Remember, there is a difference between grilling and burning.
Stephen Reichlin has a way of measuring the charcoal, dropping a bit at a time from a container.
You know, when people start out, they kind of build a raging fire and throw the food on and then somehow hope by some divine miracle that it will come out grilled. But you want to control the fire. That's why we work with multiple heat zones, hot zone for searing, medium zone for cooking, safety zone with no fire whatsoever.
Reichlin thinks about just where he places the coals and where he places those stuffed peppers on the grill.
And so I'll simply arrange them on the grill.
And we're not putting them directly over the flame.
Right,
then.
We're putting them in between the mounds of coals. That's why it's called indirect grilling.
Direct and indirect grilling. Direct grilling means the food is right over the flame. Indirect grilling means you've pushed the coals off to either side.
Anytime you grill something that is either big or fatty or needs a prolonged cooking time, or you have a dish with a filling like this one, where you actually want to cook the filling through, as well as the peppers on the exterior, you use indirect grilling. Because if we direct grilled, we'd char the peppers, but the filling wouldn't be done.
And indirect grilling is what he uses on that slab of pork shoulder. He drops some water-soaked wood chips down into the charcoal. They'll give a smoked flavor to the meat,
okay.
And then he puts the cover on.
Okay.
All right.
This is why the neighbors have been insane since 6:30 in the morning, because We did cook a pork shoulder ahead of time. Cooking time on this is about 3 hours. And what you can see, it's a beautiful, crusty, golden brown. It's so tender. I can just pull little pieces of pulled pork right off the meat. And
do you mind if I do this?
No,
same?
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm just going to grab a little bit
there. For quality control purposes.
Pretty hot.
Yeah. So, indirect grilling, about 3 hours, adding wood chips every hour, but not the last hour.
Now, the average person looking at this might fear at first glance that they had burned the meat. Because it's blackened in a lot of places.
Well, there's a difference between black and very dark brown.
Slaving for hours in the smoke under the sun, Stephen Reichlin has grilled a perfect slab of meat, which he'll now take back inside and destroy.
And then with a cleaver, we actually want to chop the pork into a fairly fine hash.
He's turning it into the filling for a pulled pork slider. Drop the meat on a soft roll with some slaw and eat.
Well, this is a gob-o' food. Wow.
Yeah.
Mmm. Oh, that's fantastic.
It's a very complex set of flavors and textures.
Textures, yeah. Some parts are really crunchy, some parts are really soft.
Yep.
And we're going to follow it with peaches, speared on cinnamon sticks, and basted with that brown sugar, butter, and bourbon directly over the flame of the grill.
You see how the ends of the cinnamon sticks are burning? And that releases all those cinnamon oils.
You're all for that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about flavor.
Actually, not quite all about flavor. For Stephen Reichlin, it's also a kind of performance art.
One of the extraordinary things about grilling, it's a public event, it's a theatrical event, it's a social event. People do not gather around a stove to watch a pot of soup simmer, or an oven to watch a cake bake. But when you grill, instantly you have a crowd.
And you can crowd onto our website for recipes and photos at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
Okay, you may think of July 4th as Independence Day, but to competitive eaters, this is the day of Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest on New York City's Coney Island. It remains among America's most popular foods, the hot dog, judging by the speed with which the hot dogs disappeared at the Inskeep family reunion over the weekend in Indiana, but not many of us know why we call them hot dogs. Our own Renee Montagne spoke with linguist Ben Zimmer.
Let's start with what often is the fun part of these searches, and that's the misinformation of how it came to be called a hot dog.
There's a bunch of myths out there. Possibly the most popular one involves a cartoonist for the New York Evening Journal named Tad Dorgan. And the story goes that around 1901, Tad Dorgan was at the Polo Grounds, which is in Upper Manhattan. It's where New York's baseball giants used to play. He was at the ball game. One of the concessionaires was selling Red Hots, these Frankfurter sausages. And he had the idea to make a cartoon with a dachshund in a roll. And so he drew this picture for his cartoon. But then supposedly he couldn't spell the word dachshund. And so he just wrote hot dog instead. This has been a very sturdy myth, even though there's not a bit of truth to this story.
And tell us about one man who really is given credit for being the original hot dog man.
Well, there's a figure that has emerged from some recent research. Yale law librarian Fred Shapiro, an intrepid word sleuth, has uncovered mention of hot dogs in Paterson, New Jersey, in a paper from December 1892, before it shows up anywhere else, as far as we know. And in Paterson, New Jersey, there was a man named Thomas Francis Xavier Morris, who was nicknamed Hot Dog Morris, who would go around, and he was a Frankfurter vendor, and he would go and sell hot dogs to people when they were skating on an ice pond or at circuses or anywhere where people were gathering. And he was known in Paterson as the Hot Dog Man. And so it's interesting that Paterson, New Jersey might actually be the key to figuring out where this term hot dog came from.
Well, if he was written up in the local newspaper, he must have been pretty well known there.
He was very well known locally, and in fact, he had this remarkable life going around Europe as a strong man before marrying a European woman, coming to the United States, and eventually settling in Paterson. He opened a restaurant, and then he started selling his Frankfurters, and he was known as Hot Dog Morris, sometimes also called Pepper Sauce Morris, because he liked to put pepper sauce as his special condiment on the food that he sold.
So nothing's certain, as is so often the case with the origins of language, but have you been able to pinpoint what you would consider its the real origin of the hot dog?
I like to think that perhaps Hot Dog Morris had a big role to play in popularizing it, maybe even coming up with the term hot dog. He had such an interesting life. He had spent time in Germany. Maybe that gave him a special knack in the Frankfurter department. And he came to Paterson, which was a city of innovation. And, you know, it would be great to think that perhaps he was the innovator in calling it a hot dog and marketing it that way. There are other early reports of hot dogs being sold in the shore towns of New Jersey, like Asbury Park and Atlantic City. So it could be a New Jersey origin, which appeals to me because I'm a New Jersey boy born and bred. And so it would be nice to see New Jersey get the credit for this one.
Ben, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Ben Zimmer is the executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus online magazine.
Hot dog. It's NPR. And now let's go to the big business of palm oil. Environmentalists have been turning their attention in recent years to tropical rainforests in Southeast Asia, where vast areas are being cut down to make way for palm oil plantations. This oil is a common ingredient in many of the foods we eat. It's often used as a substitute for trans fats, which nobody wants to eat anymore. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has the story of some young environmentalists here in the United States who are trying to focus attention on this issue. They've started by targeting palm oil use in Girl Scout cookies.
Rhiannon Tamtishin and Madison Vorva are passionate about orangutans. 4 years ago, the Michigan girls started studying them for a Girl Scout project.
I liked them at first because they are such a cute animal, but they're also helpless. Their rainforest, their home, is being cleared for these palm oil plantations, and they have no say in it.
In two decades, companies have cut down millions of acres of rainforest to plant palm trees and meet the skyrocketing demand for oil and biofuel. This releases huge amounts of greenhouse gases and shrinks habitat for rare animals like tigers, elephants, and rhinos. The girls decided to do whatever they could to tell others about orangutans' plight. Their first step was to stop eating food with palm oil in it. Madison says that's when they learned something that horrified them.
It was Girl Scout cookie season, and we checked the ingredients, and palm oil was an ingredient in the Girl Scout cookies. And I remember just being so shocked and upset.
Palm oil became ubiquitous in U.S. supermarkets a few years ago. Companies put it in baked goods, margarine, and candy as an alternative to hydrogenated oils that contain trans fat. That's not to say palm oil is health food. It's full of saturated fat, but it's cheap. In many places in the world, it has become the staple cooking oil. The girls worked with environmental groups, gathered signatures, and talked to lots of reporters. Finally, a few weeks ago, they got a sit-down meeting with Girl Scout leaders. Madison says they made an impassioned plea to take palm oil out of Girl Scout cookies.
I kind of teared up during the meeting because I care about this so much. And we showed them pictures of orangutans killed for the palm oil industry. And I think those pictures, you know, really resonated with me as a young kid, but also today.
Girl Scouts of the USA cares deeply about the environment. So, you know, of course, it was of concern.
Amanda Haymaker manages cookie sales for the organization. She says her bakers tell her they need palm oil to make the cookies taste great and resist crumbling and spoiling. And so far, there is no affordable source of sustainable palm oil. Haymaker told Madison and Rhiannon that it's too late to change the recipe for next year's cookies.
I mean, the cookie boxes have been printed.
Haymaker says she won't do anything to jeopardize cookie sales because Scouts need the money for camp, trips, and charity projects. But because of Madison and Rhiannon's dedication, she'll consider changing future batches.
We're definitely researching palm oil, and we're going to continue to keep contact with the girls.
And Rhiannon and Madison's campaign has drawn attention all the way in Southeast Asia. During a recent visit to Washington, D.C., Malaysia Plantation Minister Bernard Dompok said stories about destruction of the rainforest and orangutans are misleading.
We have enough laws in the country to prevent all this.
For instance, Dompok says Malaysia has pledged to keep half of its land forested.
I think it's time perhaps that some of these little girls get better informed on these things.
Dan saat ini Indonesia sendiri punya
Indonesia Agriculture Minister Suswano added that his country set up a conservation area for orangutans a few years ago, and it just announced a moratorium on converting primary forests to palm plantations. Conservation groups say these policies still allow destruction of rainforests, but they do indicate progress. And there are other signs that sustainable palm oil is starting to pick up momentum. For example, Kellogg's announced for every ton of oil it uses around the globe, it will subsidize sustainable palm oil. The company owns the biggest baker of Girl Scout cookies. Kellogg says when an affordable source of sustainable palm oil becomes available, the company will buy it. Doug Boucher is a tropical forest expert for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He gives Madison and Rhiannon a lot of credit.
I'm one of those grown-ups that hasn't been as successful as they have.
Boucher predicts Girl Scout cookies soon will become rainforest friendly because two teenagers wanted to save orangutans. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Fridays don't get better than this. Ahead, a long holiday weekend kicking off on the first day of National Ice Cream Month. In declaring July Ice Cream Month, President Reagan cited nutritional benefits and said it should be observed with, quote, appropriate ceremonies and activities, like eating ice cream. And Americans eat more ice cream than anyone else in the world, an average 20 quarts a year or several cones a week. It's Morning Edition.